up to yonder, beyond the lights, neon, fluorescent. My essence is something to ponder. Your talent ain't something to squander. Blessed and favored so highly, anointed and portrait I might be. This is that all that podcast featuring Kyrie.
What is up, folks? We are back with another episode, and this one will be a little spicy. This one will be a little unconventional because this topic doesn't necessarily get talked about that often. And that is liberal racism. And so, you know, whenever you bring up the topic of racism, usually the conversation is surrounded by extremists, you know, people who use the N-word and people who, you know, it's the alt-right and, you know, the good old boys, those people, you know, when you bring up this conversation. But you never really hear the term liberal racism, or as Robin DiAngelo coined it, nice racism. So, and, you know, me reading both of her books, it made sense to me, and it's something that I personally could relate to, because never in my life have I been explicitly called the N-word, or, you know, have I experienced explicit racism. It's always been colorblind racism from people that I was around on a daily basis. Before we get really into the podcast, I want to introduce my guest, Garrett. How are you?
Good. Hey, thanks for having me. I'm not sure if I can deliver on the spiciness, but, you know, I'm here to provide the very important white man perspective that everybody wants to hear on every issue.
So. Right. And a little background, we actually recorded this podcast already.
Yeah.
I'm not naming, you know, the place, or, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, talk down on anybody's business. It just wasn't what I expected out of the finished product with the audio and the visual and all that. So it's all good. We're here again. We kind of changed up the topic a little bit, but we're back.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if anything, it's good that we're just having that conversation anyway.
Right.
It's not being recorded.
You know, right. Something that, you know, we still talk about. So personally, where do you even start?
It's like, you know,
it's just, okay.
I could go into, you know, kind of where I grew up and basically, you know, the example of somebody that grows
right.
up in the.
I was about to jump to my personal experiences, but we can wait to get there. So how did you grow up, your household? How was your household in regards to race? You know, your environment, your community, where did you grow up? You know, how was that? Were you around a lot of African Americans? All that. Yeah. Tell us.
So I grew up in a suburb northeast of Houston. It's called Kingwood. Mm-hmm. But like most suburbs outside the city, it is majority white. And definitely grew up with the values of don't see color.
Like, right.
Just treat everybody the same. Don't see color. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's kind of funny looking back on it now. You know, we really were colorblind, because if you look around, there's no black people there. So I'm really not seeing
It's
color.
Easy to be colorblind,
yeah,
right?
I'm actually not seeing color.
Right.
And at no point do you stop and wonder, like, no, there are no black people that live in my neighborhood.
Right.
Better not think about that anymore.
Mm-hmm. You know,
better move on to something else.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't even a part of your psyche. Having to have this relationship with a person of color, or learning how to interact with them, or what you should or should not do, wasn't even a part of your world growing up.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. It wasn't focused. It wasn't a part of our socialization. So even, you know, we had probably 10 to 20 black students at my school.
Mm-hmm. Out of
even
4,000 or something?
Out of several thousand.
Yeah.
So even, you know, for them, I think being socialized in that environment maybe socialized them to not talk about, you know, racism that they experience or how race affects their lives. So
right,
it just never came up.
If you mind speaking on your experience growing up, watching how your parents interacted with race, I know you said that it was very colorblind, but did you see anything else that could have maybe contradicted it or that could have backed up what they're saying. Just tell your experience from observing your parents. You don't have to put your parents' business out there, if you don't want to, but if you're comfortable.
No, you know, just like everybody else that grew up in those communities.
Yeah.
You know, I felt lucky at the time. I still feel lucky to an extent that, you know, of course, my parents, even, you know, acknowledging that the colorblind view is, you know, really kind of a ridiculous thing to think.
Yes,
and
you must
can,
see
can even be counterproductive. You know, they still at least had that ideal, I suppose. That,
right.
But I guess where you kind of, where the rubber meets the road and you realize that even saying that isn't true is maybe not when I was growing up, but recently, like involving like Black Lives Matter protests and
MAGA,
or even you know, Obama's presidency.
Oh yeah, yeah, that was the precursor to all this, really. Yeah.
Politics aside, and a big part of it is because of the socialization that they experience. The news they consume is all
right.
You know, Fox News or now just Facebook memes and posts that just reinforce this toxic mindset. And so if all they're seeing on the news is, you know, Fox News just repeating one incident of, you know, something violent that happened at a massive rally that had thousands of people, they're not going to show any of it except the one, you know, violent incident, and then just show that on repeat. And
so that's,
in their minds, you know, they might be able to say, like, yeah, that what happened to George Floyd was horrible. That cop should be in prison.
But
you know, at the same time, we should also watch out about
the
Black Lives Matter protests, because that's a big problem. Or, you know, even people that would absolutely say they weren't racist, like the things that people would say about Barack Obama, or even worse, Michelle Obama, prior to his election, and then while he was in office, were, I mean, just really disgusting things that, even with how much everybody hates Hillary Clinton, I never saw the same types of insults thrown
at Hillary Clinton
that I've seen thrown at Michelle Obama.
And at least with Hillary, you would have, you can back it up and say that there is a reason that you're being mean-spirited to this person. But with Barack, it went beyond politics, and especially with Michelle, because she's not even a politician.
Right.
You know? So, yeah.
And, well, and because so much of it, especially with Michelle, would be around her looks. Which, on the one hand, is strange, because just, like, looking back on the history of, like, first ladies, she, you know, to me, objectively, was, you know, one of the more beautiful first ladies we've had.
Right.
You know, like, even as much as I hate the Trumps, like, I would never be tempted to be like, Melania Trump is so ugly.
No.
Like, she looks like a man.
You would never say that. Yeah.
And that was, like, the type of things that you would see, you know, being said about Michelle Obama. And, you know, even post-Obama, like, in a review of his presidency, you know, I'm not a huge supporter anymore, you know, at the time I was. I don't think he fulfilled his, you know, promises to the level that I would have liked. And so none of, you know, my critique of this is coming from a place of, that's my team. And
bias,
that's
why
It was just the things that I would see said about him were just shocking. And so I think even people that think when they're saying these things, that's not coming from a racist place. It's like so obviously a reflection
of some
embedded sort of internalized racism, you know, that we just don't face.
So I'm curious to know and understand, you know, we're talking about the trajectory of your life and, you know, you were raised up in this colorblind community, you know, you didn't really have to be conscious of anything involving race, really, growing up. So, but me knowing you now, and I know how knowledgeable you are, how educated you are in a lot of things, but specifically in African-American history, African-American issues, things going on with the African-American community. So what was the push or the thing that got you interested in really deep diving into this?
Yeah, it's hard to pinpoint, you know, anything specific as like a catalyst for that. But definitely learning like true history of this country. Certainly, like, I don't know how it is everywhere else, but in the Texas educational system, what you learn growing up is mostly that, you know, America are the good guys in all situations. We have, of course, we go over slavery. That was so long ago.
Yeah.
So unbelievably long
ago. Now we don't even teach it in schools.
You know, and then after that, there's some hand waving at, you know, Jim Crow. And then since then, you know, you just kind of brush over everything else. And, you know, I think about even now, like how our history books are going to read about, you know, the war in Afghanistan and, you know, how it's just going to pass over, like, the real, like, horror of...
It'll be romanticized.
Of what we did there.
Right.
And so, you know, along those same lines, it's never asked of you in these classes to, you know, really face the idea that our country has been the bad guys that we see, China or Russia, or,
right,
you know, in its own way. And, you know, these things get so muddied because politically, we, you know, politicians and the media create this culture war. And so, you know, rather than just having like a normal conversation about let's teach real history, they create buzzwords like critical race theory or, you know, woke politics and all this like crap so that, you know, people's attention spans are so short.
Right.
And
especially so now.
Getting them attached to like these culture wars that they can fight in a few tweets and then they can just, you know, develop this, you know, this mindset that they're not going to listen to that in any case because, you know, they're trying to teach kids to hate our country and to be Marxists. And
right.
It's like, no, there's just a real history in this country that we didn't learn. And learning it would help us understand where we are now.
And not repeat
it. It's not about hating your country. It's about, you know, we're trying to build a better world. We're trying to build a better society all the time. And so, you know, it's impossible to do that when you're only going to learn about your country through this lens of, you know, everything we do is from the position of the good guy. And especially passing over so many of the instances of government racial policies that resulted in harm today, which is why discussions around, say, like reparations are so untouchable for so many, you know, politicians, because, you know, in the most recent discussion, you know, I think even Mitch McConnell said, well, slavery was so long ago, nobody's alive for that today. And I just read a book, I can't remember what it's called, I'll have to look it up afterwards, but in his argument for reparations, slavery's not even part of it. Like,
you don't have to
being paid back for, like,
the housing,
the wage, you know, the work done by slaves,
right,
was not part of the argument at all. You know, it starts with the Homestead Act.
Homestead Act.
You know, during, you know, the westward expansion, all white families were given 100 acres of land in the Western Territories, and freed black people post Civil War were promised 40 acres
which and a mule
already, and the mule, but you know they never got 1 acre. After Lincoln was assassinated, then Andrew Johnson canceled that policy, and so from there, there's a, you know, to the present, there's a cascading series of events.
They had a slave owners got reparations. Slavery got abolished.
Our government's paid reparations.
To almost every, a lot of groups that's gotten way less harm done to them compared to the African American race, they've gotten paid reparations.
In my
hometown, there is in Port Arthur, 9th Avenue, It's called Chinatown. That was reparations paid to Asians from war. We've been paying reparations to people, but when it comes to the African American issue, it's like,
But you know, there's too much history there that even if I'd memorized it, it would be too hard to just regurgitate in, you know, in an hour or less.
Oh, for sure.
But you know, just that act alone, and then all the events since, you know, housing discrimination and GI Bill and the New Deal policies that excluded African Americans. All of those things have like direct influence on the wealth gap today that can be traced pretty directly, and you can put a monetary value on that. So we're not, you know, we're not even including the wages that slaves would be paid because that It's an impossible number.
It really is. It's probably be in the trillions of dollars.
But in well, even without it, it's in the trillions of dollars.
Exactly.
And, you know, which we can afford it. There's no question about that. But, you know, it's really just a basic legal case in that he's viewing these specific instances of government policies from since, you know, slavery to the present. And each one of these things has this huge impact on the difference in wealth between the average white family and the average black family. And even like the Homestead Act, you know,
which created the middle class pretty much.
Right. And an absurd amount of white people's wealth today. And some amount can be traced back to just that act.
Just that.
So something like over 100 million Americans can trace their wealth back to just that act.
Right.
And there's so many cents that, you know, most people have never heard of.
No, exactly. So, that's a look. I'm a big proponent of not necessarily school education, just educating yourself. Because just like you said, a lot of people won't even they'll listen to this podcast and be like, I didn't even know that, you know. But it's just self-education that'll help a lot. But I want to get to this: your thirst for knowledge. And you coming across these stories and this history, and you getting a better understanding of at least what African Americans have been through. How do you think that has shaped your relationships that you have with African American people?
That's a really interesting question. I think one of the main things is definitely from people on the right politically, or even, you know, white liberals. Have always tended to view ourselves or whiteness as racially neutral.
Right.
And it's something that we don't consider as part of our identity because we've never had to.
Right.
And, you know, that's why when people talk about identity politics, they're talking about everybody else. We don't, you know, I don't have identity politics. Right. I don't view things through the lens of my identity, which, of course, is a lie because, you know, if it's not identity politics, what is it when you are furious that Colin Kaepernick is not standing up for your favorite song?
Right.
You know, that's, you know, patriotism and, you know, support for, you know, Blue Lives Matter. That's all identity politics.
Right.
And it just becomes even more ridiculous through the lens of, you know, the fact that, you know, Colin Kaepernick chose to kneel because he talked to a teammate of his that was a Green Beret that suggested to him, hey, I think kneeling would be a better idea than staying on the
military.
Bench because then you can show respect to the military, which I think, you know, even having to do that is a weird thing in our society. But even doing that, the reaction was still, he's disrespecting our military. You know, he hates America. It's like, no, he's being very specific. About
the reason is, and we're talking about liberal people who would say, you know, I don't use the N-word, or they'll look at, you know, an extremist racist and be like, you know, I'm not that, you know what I mean? I'm not a bad person, but when you won't come out straight out and say you don't agree with what somebody's saying or protesting, then you'll attack how they did it and where they did it.
Right.
So for a lot of liberal people, white people, it wouldn't be, you know, it wouldn't be quote unquote politically correct for them to come out and say, I don't agree with Colin Kaepernick kneeling against police brutality.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not going to say that. So let me say, I don't like the way he did it.
Right.
Because if you really agree with what he was saying, it wouldn't matter.
Yeah.
Especially when the man came out repeatedly and said, hey, I'm not disrespecting the military.
Right.
I asked a member of the military what to do. He told me to do this. And you have veterans who came out in support of Kaepernick.
Any of my friends in the military that I've asked, like, does that bother you? No, why would it bother me?
Exactly.
It has nothing to do with me.
Exactly.
And it's a weird gesture anyway, this, you know, like I'm saying, that is an identity politics, this visceral reaction to somebody not being patriotic.
Right.
When even that on its own is like, you know, for the last, you know, 20 plus years, we've operated a torture island in Guantanamo Bay. That's a thing our country does.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just this, you know, this blind loyalty to, you know, we can have our discussions about politics, but support for right. the flag overall, and you know that's beyond reproach. Yeah. Is just strange, but
you, I don't want to interrupt you, but you, the people critiquing how somebody chooses to protest is unpatriotic,
right? Yeah. And it's a complete distraction.
Yeah, yeah.
You
know,
if you want to argue what his point is,
right? Then, that's a whole different story.
Do that, but
right.
Yeah, it's
exactly
again. It's they create this culture war to mm-hmm. distract people rather than like we can have a normal conversation about it.
It's a lost art conversation that is.
You know, that's what I find most frustrating about politics, and especially people from the right that think one that mm-hmm. they don't use identity politics,
right?
While they wage this culture war of mm-hmm. what's basically a distraction from just facts we can talk about and issues we can discuss normally,
right?
But yeah, to circle back to. You know, how, you know, I've changed mm-hmm. and, you know, the idea that white people view themselves subconsciously mm-hmm. as racially neutral.
Right.
I guess, you know, an easy example would be maybe one of the first times or even still, you know, when mm-hmm. we're hanging out, like, as a group. Like,
yeah.
You know, me, you, Jay, James, Al, you know, mm-hmm. whoever. You know, a lot of the places we'll go are generally more like black spaces.
Right.
You know, it'll be because another thing that's just never talked about is how segregated we still are in society.
I think they had a statistic that say we're more segregated now, at least in schooling.
It could be true.
Probably just across the board than we were in the 60s, which is insane.
And like I said, you know, it really never occurred to me as something to question growing up.
Right.
But yeah, so, you know, we'll often spend a lot of our time in black spaces or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it is, bars, restaurants that, you know, are majority like
black
people that mm-hmm. that go there. And so definitely like my first time there. But yeah, even still, it's like sometimes I'll just feel like really for no reason, like, am I out of place here? Like,
yeah.
Are people looking at me here? Like, he shouldn't be here.
Right.
Like, you know, like, how do I walk as not racistly as possible? Like,
right. So now that you've been put in that position, you have a unique perspective, because the majority of white people never have to feel like the minority all across their life. But for us, that's the norm, because chances are we work in corporate America. It's going to be mainly white. We, you know,
right.
all these spaces are majority white. And so we have to be. Now you get to feel how we have to feel just in everyday life.
It's not even
on
that
level.
There's really no reason for me to feel like
right.
It's only being,
it's being
a minority in a space.
Right.
There is no larger structure of oppression.
Right.
There's nobody actually.
So it's not even on the same level. So you get a little taste.
Treating me worse.
Right.
It's entirely just, you know, like
right.
an emotional,
a mental thing
response. But it is, you know, still like it's something that like affects you.
Right.
And so. You know, yeah, then as you just mentioned, like the idea that for several centuries now in this country, we've built basically a giant white space in society. And as you said, you know, most of our government, you know, most of CEOs, billionaires, you know,
across the board,
conference rooms
mm-hmm.
like, have been built as white spaces, not just in majority, you know, skin color, but also the way you're supposed to act or the way you're supposed to look.
Right.
Which is, you know, I just watched even like things that seem trivial. Like, you know, I watched some YouTube clip and it made me think of like where I grew up, where it was a girl just calling around to every barbershop in the place that she lived, asking if they had any experience or ability to handle like 4C type curly hair. That, you know, that she has as a black
yeah.
woman, and not a single one said like they would know what to do with it.
Right.
And so, you know, that's just a small example, but still, yeah, the idea of having to live your whole life in that kind of space mm-hmm. is exhausting.
To say the least.
And, you know, that's why I think I mentioned last time, like the, and kind of reference to Robin DiAngelo's first book, White Fragility,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, I've even told you there's a lot of that I don't exactly agree with.
Yeah.
You know, it does explain that so much is because white people viewing themselves as racially neutral, not having to view you know, their experiences through their identity, haven't had to develop that kind of emotional maturity around the subject of race that, you know, Black people have to develop.
It's never been a, you never had to, you know, even think that. And I had a crazy, it's not really crazy, but when I had this thought, it kind of blew my mind. I was like, I have white people in my life that I know for a fact would step in front of a bullet for me, but are still racist. It's a crazy idea to get wrap around your head, but that is just a fact. Like, you know, you listen to them talk about certain things, and you'd be like, because it's really like, I'm an anomaly. You know what I mean? It's just like, it's me. Like, they see me, like, he's a good one. That's the thought process. But it's, no, I'm not a quote-unquote good one. I'm just Black. You know what I mean? Like, there's no, you know, they kind of make it like, oh, he's a rare breed in his race. But no, it's not, that's not the case. But, you know, that thought just was crazy to me. Like, they'll step in front of a bullet for me. But if they didn't know me and I was George Floyd, then they'll be like, he a thug. He did this. He did that. He did that. Wow. And the reason I wanted to do this podcast on liberal racism or nice racism or about white people who think, you know, because, you know, the extremist gives them somebody to look down upon to make them still feel like they're good people. I'm not saying, you know, they're bad, you know, when in regards to race, right? So they can say, I'm not like that. I would never use the N-word, but you still won't hire, you know, Black people in leadership, or you still won't, you know what I mean? So... And only time, the white people I've been hurt by personally were those close to me. I had a friend, and I'm just being, hey, I'm being completely transparent, so, you know, people hear this and, you know, whatever. Had a friend, my best friend, grew up, you know, real close, staying together, you know, real close to this man. And, you know, when we got out of high school... And around the time, you know, Trump and he started coming about and all this, it just started revealing things that I've never seen, that I've never heard. And it was like, and then obviously the friendship is no more, but that hurt me. You know what I mean? This is since middle school, you know what I mean? And it was a kind of separation from all his Black friends. You know what I mean? And it was like, dang. So with that, and we often have these relationships, right? Where we kind of let, you know, a white person in and then boom. And, you know, and now it's kind of like you have to pick and choose and you have to be very careful. You know what I mean? Like with you, like you're well studied. You're comfortable hanging around us. Like I know, you know, the police come, I know you're gonna step in the front. You know, I know.
I did do that.
Yeah, you did. You know what I mean? So right. So I know, you know, where you come from. Like, you know, I feel like I can trust you. But, you know, I think that's a big thing for a lot of us is the trust thing. Like, should I, you know what I mean? Because even if your intentions are well, you can still get me killed. Or, you know what I mean? Or not put me in a position when you really could have, you know what I mean? Or something like that. And I work at a country club, which is the epitome of whiteness. You know what I mean? You can't get more white than a country club. And for me, as one out of two, the only two Black men, people, period, in the whole building, it's a very taxing. You know what I mean? To walk into work and overhear conversations and, oh, you're great, Kyrie. But you're people. You know what I mean? Like, you're great. You're a good. They never came to me and said that. But I'm just saying, but you can tell, like, you're great, but you're people. You know what I mean? So it's very taxing. And even the good ones, even the good ones can be harmful. You know what I mean? So it's a very taxing thing to navigate. And I don't even know where I was going with that, but I just wanted to get that off my chest and tell you and the listeners my experience and a lot of Black people's experience when it comes to, you know, dealing with having relationships with white people. And I don't want to sound like, you know, all white people are but it's just like that lack of understanding. You know what I mean? Like you said, like I have to go everywhere. and know that I'm black.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I have to be conscious of it.
Yeah.
When I step in a room, I'm conscious that I'm black. There's no other black people in this room.
Yeah.
And I even feel like I got to be a representation of my race. That is a weight that no white person has to carry.
Yeah.
You rule the this world was made for you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, yeah. So as a white person, and you're well aware of your privilege, and you're as somebody who has relationships with African Americans, and who cares about African American people. What are some things that you think you can do and that you are doing to not make things easier, is not the right word, but to further, you know, help our experience in America? I mean, I know you don't have like a huge platform to do,
right.
You know what I mean? But even on your small platform,
yeah.
You know, what are you doing or what do you think you can do to bring consciousness?
Yeah, I mean... just to start to, mm-hmm. you know, put a final puzzle piece to that picture you just painted,
I mean,
how you said, you know, you feel like you do have to carry your race mm-hmm. everywhere. And it's like, all it took was like me one time going to a bar with, you know, where I was the only white person there.
Yeah.
And I'm immediately aware that I'm the only
right.
white person.
Right. It's like,
there.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and so I'm immediately aware of, yeah, everything I'm doing, how I might be being perceived.
Right.
And... you know, it's this, just to lead into then your next question, I think one of the better points made in that book,
mm-hmm.
Nice Racism, is mm-hmm. the idea that we're allowed to kind of maintain this system of, you know, nice racism.
Right.
Or, you know, or just indifference
mm-hmm.
without, like, seeing or understanding that, like, what we lose in doing that. Even as non-Black Americans, just
right.
what we lose, because it is, you know, it is such a, like, just even in my life, you know, a basic concrete example would be like, if I were like listing the 10 like happiest moments in my life, half of them involve things we've done,
right?
You know, and, you know, beyond that, just the identity, the fact that I could go to a bar that was, you know, almost entirely, you know, black,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that, like, I feel, like, out of place there, or I feel this, like, adversarial tension, like, even if it's just in my head, is, like,
right.
such a major consequence of, you know, what we lose when, you know, we don't have this, like, community, like, we don't have this, like, sense of love for, like, everyone that lives around us.
Right.
And especially when, you know, we love to take just a few parts of, you know, black culture that's formed in America. And, you know, we love to incorporate that, you know, it basically
mm-hmm.
athletes until they express their political opinions. But, you know, as long as they want to win games for our team,
right.
you know, musical artists, even, you know, vernacular is like so much of black culture. Then, like,
I even hear this all the time. Basically the shut up and dribble notion, you know what I mean? Like, this owner is paying you all this money and you're talking, or you want out,
right.
but you'll never hear anybody talking about the amount of money that the owner is making,
right.
or the amount of money that the player is making the owner.
Yeah.
You know, no athlete, well, especially the major athletes, all of them are underpaid.
Yeah.
Because if you really pay them their true value, they never get paid their true value. LeBron never gets paid his true value.
Right.
If he got paid his true value, he'll be making $500 million a year.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, but you never hear anything about the owner. It's only the player needs to stay in his place because he's been privileged to have this big contract.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's it's an upsetting reflection of
mm-hmm.
Again, what we've been raised to ignore about with the idea that we live in a colorblind society, and,
mm-hmm.
and we know, you know, there's still, of course, everybody will say, of course, there's still racism, but as you said, you know, in their head, it's, we're thinking of white nationalists,
mm-hmm.
or, and, you know, we view racism in our mind as good and bad.
Right.
And so we're good people, so we're not racist, rather than, you know, we all grow up with internal biases and we've all been socialized. So you know, if it helps you to think about it, it's not your fault.
Yeah.
But exactly. It is up to you what you do now.
Yep.
And you can't do anything if you don't recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a big part, just as an individual, especially like a white man, mm-hmm. that has kind of done at least some of that work, is you can't shy away from those conversations with other people. Because, you know, as we've talked about, how just me realizing how emotionally exhausting it must be, mm-hmm. to, again, be a black person in so many white spaces, you know, you can't also then expect black Americans to then, again, continue doing everything, you know, all the work to explain themselves to,
mm-hmm.
you know, white, you know, liberal society who, one, their own internalized biases are going to, you know, preclude them to hear mm-hmm. it coming from a black voice oftentimes. And again, two, it's just the emotional labor of it. It's, I can't imagine undertaking that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think a big part of it is just standing up in those situations where it would be easier not to, because, you know, a lot of people like to, there's this weird idea that in staying neutral mm-hmm. in a political or social discussion, that there's some kind of virtue in that. Like, you know, I see both sides of the argument and, you know, I wish we could just be nicer to each other.
Why can't we all get along?
Yeah. And, you know, I would love if everyone was nicer to each other. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's no value in not taking a side. You know, there's a right side and there's a wrong side. And
right.
You may not know exactly what that is. And obviously both sides think they're right. But again, just simply maintaining the status quo
mm-hmm.
is not brave in any way, not challenging the systems of power or, you know, the structure of our government that leads us into unnecessary wars and, you know, just horrific allocations of money and corruption, and either, you know, one, being distracted by this culture war stuff, or again, deciding not to take a side in any of it, because that's something you can do when you're a white person.
Right.
And, you know, maybe you have liberal values, but yeah, it's something you can not take a side on. You can say that, you know, that police officer should go to jail, but Black Lives Matter is a violent organization and they're a threat. And
that's something also that started losing friendships when social media came about, and all of these police shootings and all this political stuff started coming at the same time. And you see people you went to school with or that you are friendly with, and you hear their opinions. It's like, dang. Like, okay.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing.
Yeah.
Like, all right. That's how you really think. And it's kind of disheartening, you know, to see that, because these are people you think are your friends. But I always say this, and I would never allow a white person to tell me that I'm a good black person, because right. I'm just a good person, whatever that means. I don't even believe in good and bad people, but just to go off of that, you know what I mean? I'm a good person. I'm not a good black person.
Right.
You know what I mean? There's not a shortage of good black people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, once you see that, man, it's kind of like, all right, it's the trust issues again.
Yeah.
Goes back to the trust issues.
And
yeah,
you know, the response to this visceral agitation caused by, you know, what they would call identity politics, or,
right.
you know, again, just having to talk about racism is, you know, we don't like being viewed as white people.
Yeah.
We don't like being identified by our skin color. That,
right.
That doesn't feel good.
I'm an American.
So, yeah. So,
yeah.
You know, no shortage of irony there that, you know.
Right.
One second of that and
Yeah.
You know, we're really sick of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, again, because things get so toxic and, you know, the culture war side of it, you know, people don't realize when we're hanging out, it's not, this isn't what we're talking about all the time. It's not the only thing on our mind is.
It really never comes up,
you know,
actually.
As a black man, kind yeah. of, hey, you know, would you like to
You're right.
go get a beer with me, a white man?
Yeah.
You know, it's not.
Or would you rather Hennessy?
Yeah.
yeah.
You know, it's not this fear that's built up about critical race theory and
yeah.
things like that. It's not. It's just about understanding that you have been socialized and, you know, there's parts of your psychology that are just an
yep.
obvious consequence of growing up how you did.
Mm-hmm.
And those things are subconsciously affecting, like, the way you think. And even if, you know, you're sure that it's not happening to you, then it's happening, you know, in society all
right.
There's no shortage
right.
of sociological studies of, you know, like, applications where people would use what obviously seemed like a black name and a white name, or, you know, college admissions. We've done,
right.
you know, countless, you know, examples of this in which people that I'm sure would identify as non-racist,
mm-hmm.
you know, continually favor white names, white faces. It's just hard to kind of bend that mirror back
mm-hmm.
in front of you to realize, you know, it's not about hating yourself as a white person or feeling white guilt or any of that. It's,
right.
look, we have a problem and, like, let's work to fix it.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah,
it's just people just need to understand duality. Like, you can be a quote unquote liberal and still be racist. You can have a daughter and still be sexist. You know what I mean? You can,
right.
it's a duality. You can be simultaneously two things at the same time. Just because, you know, you never call anybody the N-word doesn't mean you're not racist.
Right.
Actually, and you know, there's proof to back me up on this, it is the nice white person
yeah.
that does the most harm to African Americans in present day. Now,
yeah.
you know, but yeah, in present day, though they do the most harm.
Yeah.
They are the ones that, you know, run these companies, you know, holding the diversity training and all this, but you don't have nobody in your leadership, you know, nobody in any high positions that's of color, you know, it's your friends that you've grown up with, and you start hearing, you know, how they really feel. It's it's really the quote unquote nice white people. And it's like, going back to the country club real quick, you know, you just have to walk in and things get brought up to you that you know for a fact that your white coworkers never have to hear.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, just the assumption that I voted for Biden because I'm black.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, that is the assumption of it. You know what I mean? Like, oh, you see, they come up to me and start talking about Biden. How do you know I like Biden?
Yeah.
Do I not? Even Joe Biden would call himself a nice white person. You know, he did, you know, he said he did civil rights stuff, he did all this and blah, 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 blah. But he got on a Breakfast Club and said, if you don't vote for me, you ain't black.
Yeah.
What? You know what I mean? So it's all these things. And I'm gonna give you the last word because we gotta get out of here in 3 minutes because Garrett is so dedicated to this black cause that he showed up 30 minutes late, like a black person would. So you go.
Let's cut that.
So I'm going to give you the last word and go.
All right. You know, it's hard to tie a bow on that because, you know, we could spend all day talking.
This could be a 2-3-4 parter because it's so
And
fast.
On each one of these points, I feel like I could just go off on a
right.
tangent about
yeah, exactly.
any given thing and about
mm-hmm.
how that's kind of obvious in other parts of, you know, American society. And, you know, we didn't even get into some of the things we wanted to talk about last time, really, like, you know,
right.
reparations. We touched on it a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, how that would look. And, you know, because I think for that, too, like, if that were to ever happen, it would have to be direct payments. Something that
mm-hmm.
banks or debtors, like student debt or anything like that. Something that outside forces couldn't get their hands on because everybody would come calling for it. Or, you know, other things I would like to see, like, you know, universal health care. And just the idea that uplifting everyone in a society makes everyone's life better.
Fannie Lou Hamer, nobody's free until everybody's free.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, so much of, you know, nothing, you know, personal wealth is never going to make you happier than living in a community where, like, you know, you feel...
It's cohesion.
Yeah, well, you know, where you feel, like, love, where you feel this, you know, this bond with the people that live around you. And, you know, that applies, you know, to everybody. And, you know, we can talk about that, and a lot of those things would include, you know, uplifting Black Americans as, you know, the historically most oppressed and therefore the most underrepresented economically now. But also, you know, beyond that, just understanding our specific history regarding how this country's treated Black Americans.
Right.
And, you know, atoning for that because it's the right thing to do. And, you know, what we can fix, we should. You know, I wish we had some more time, but
I know, right?
You know, it's too many ideas.
We'll have to have a part two, but for sure. But thank you for coming on. You know, I just thought you would be the perfect person to bring on for this topic, because you don't only talk, you walk the walk, so to speak. And to my white listeners who would say you're a nice person, you know, some things, some of advice. Is one, divorce this idea of being a good person, because with that idea, it kind of keeps you safe and it doesn't allow you to grow. And stop comparing yourself to extremists, because that's also something that keeps you comfortable, because at least you're not that, right? So if you're serious about helping out your African-American friends or just African-Americans at large, get educated. That's the number one thing. You know, once every white person I talked to and I brought things to them that was serious about, you know, really learning and really, you know, doing the work. Because if I presented this information to somebody who was going to be stuck in their ways anyway, it wouldn't matter. But the ones that I presented this information to that really were curious and they got to see all of this, they immediately was like, whoa, I had no idea. And, you know, and so it's education is important for the extremists out there that might be listening, which I doubt it if you are. But if you are, therapy is very important, because if you are an extreme racist, you need help. I'm a big proponent of therapy across the board, but especially for extremists, go get some help. Go get some therapy. Even for the quote unquote nice white people, there are inherent biases, like Garrett said, in you. Passed on from generation to generation to generation to generation. Even if you consciously don't feel like you feel a certain way about Black people, there are things inside of you. It's undoubted. Go get therapy. You know what I mean? Go get therapy. Get that out of you. Get educated and divorce the idea of being a good person, because that hinders you from growth. So there it is. Thank you, Garrett, for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
We'll probably do a part two to this. We have to, because there's so much to cover.
Yeah.
And next time I'm going to tell you that the podcast starts an hour earlier. And but yeah, I'm just kidding. But yeah, guys, we're out. Peace.